From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Congressman Stephen Lynch wants to be chair of the powerful House Oversight Committee. He says the committee's work on impeachment is crucial to American democracy.
We can't just let the election process work itself out, in my opinion. This president won't allow that. He has taken meaningful steps to interfere or cause others to interfere in the election.
Also today, can we restore civility in our public discourse? Should we? And does the courage of our convictions get in the way?
People don't abandon their philosophy merely because they're getting along.
And it's Halloween week, which for a lot of people means heading to a haunted house.
You know, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, you feel very alive and engaged.
So why do we go get scared? We'll take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch is running to chair the powerful House Oversight and Reform Committee. The job became vacant after former Chairman Elijah Cummings of Maryland passed away this month. Oversight is the main investigative committee in the House of Representatives. It has a key role in the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Today, the committee members heard closed-doors testimony from Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council. We spoke to Congressman Lynch from the Capitol just a bit ago, and he started by telling us about Colonel Vindman's testimony.
You know, Tiziana, this is a classified briefing. I know he released a statement, but I'm going to try to be careful not to to relate the substance of his testimony before the committee, if I can.
Fair enough. So let me give you a quote from what's been released publicly to react to. He said, quote, "In the spring of 2019, I became aware of outside influencers promoting a false narrative of Ukraine inconsistent with the consensus views of the interagency. This narrative was harmful to U.S. government policy. While my interagency colleagues and I were becoming increasingly optimistic on Ukraine's prospects, this alternative narrative undermined U.S. government efforts to expand cooperation with Ukraine." Do you feel like that public piece of the statement is something you can respond to?
Sure I can. You know, just from his opening statement and what he's made public, of course. I would say that Lieutenant Colonel Vindman is, a career military. I think he related the fact that his family, you know, I guess were Ukrainian refugees at one point. He has a strong affinity for the work that is being done to clean up corruption in that country, that Zelensky, the new president, ran on a campaign of anti-corruption and cleaning up the legal system and the government. He also believes that that Ukraine is really fighting a fight not only on behalf of their own country and their own freedom against Russia, but also that it's in a way defending Europe and in part the United States. So he does have a patriotic view of things, and I think he is he's invested in making sure that the U.S. and Ukraine have a very strong relationship.
And I take it you found his testimony both credible and compelling.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's talk.
The other piece of this, just so I could. So we and also the Republican members really went step by step on his response and how he responded to his immediate superiors, how he followed the chain of command precisely, and went to those legal counsel that he was supposed to go to and raise those concerns, and really, and I think, follow the letter of the law in this case. So at least at this point, there's been no character assassination attempts by the Republicans with regard to his testimony.
Okay, Congressman, let's talk about the House Oversight Committee. It's part of the ongoing impeachment inquiry. Can you give us a sense what the committee's role in that process is?
Well, of course. We're the chief investigative committee in the Congress. Other than matters that are classified and subject to Intelligence Committee review, we have the ability to investigate any matter that is of central concern to the United States and to our national security. That's the subcommittee that I have, the subcommittee on national security. So it's a committee of unlimited jurisdiction and with extraordinary powers, especially the power to subpoena witnesses and bring them before the committee.
So, Congressman, you want to chair that committee. Why do you think you're the best person to run it?
Well, you know, I've been doing this for 18 years, and you do anything for 18 years and you get to be good at it. I'm the only attorney that's seeking the position right now. And if you look at what we're doing with respect to impeachment, you know, it's almost like multi-party complex litigation. We're fighting with the Senate. We're in a contest with the White House over documents. We're fighting with the State Department, and we're in several separate litigation procedures in federal court, both in New York and here in Washington D.C. So it's very complex. And I think Elijah, who was also an attorney,
Elijah Cummings,
colleague, right? Elijah Cummings. Did have a good sense of that and sort of manage this as a broader legal response to what the White House was doing. So I think bringing that to the table, you know, and being a counterpoint to Jim Jordan on impeachment will be an important interface between ourselves and the White House.
Congressman, there are two people running to be chair. You are the most senior of those two people, but you're not the longest serving member of the committee. Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney of New York holds that distinction. Do you think seniority should be a factor in who's chosen to be the chair?
Sure. I think it should be a factor. Definitely. I think the longer you work on issues, and I've been working on oversight for, like I say, 18 years, the better you get at it. And look, I think we have probably four candidates that have announced for this seat, and they're all very capable. I don't intend to, you know, to run a campaign on proving how they are inadequate. That's far from the case. I just try to emphasize the skill set that I bring in terms of our ability to, you know, to manage this impeachment effort against the president.
Congressman, you've laid out how critical the committee is, really, in the impeachment probe. You held out on calling for this inquiry for a long time. You said at one point you were worried that impeachment proceedings would give Donald Trump another 4 years. Do you still have any reluctance about the impeachment or the process?
No, I think with the testimony, and that was all before I heard the testimony of Ambassador Taylor, by the way, and the text of the phone call was revealed by the White House. So, look, I can promise you this. We will prove the case. We will prove the case that the president broke the law, high crime. And you know, we'll prosecute that case when the time is right and after we've, you know, exhausted all the witnesses that we have waiting to testify and we get the documents that we're fighting for in court. You know, but it'll be based on facts and legal precedents. Now, I don't know if that means the Republicans in the Senate will live up to their oaths to, you know, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. I don't know if that'll work, but I don't think we have any choice at this point. This president has taken steps to enlist a foreign power to tamper with the election, to do a political hit on Joe Biden. So, we can't just let the election process work itself out, in my opinion. This president won't allow that. He has taken meaningful steps to interfere or cause others to interfere in the election. So
Congressman, the next step in the inquiry is this formal vote on Thursday,
right,
which would bring the proceedings into a new public phase. Democrats so far have been reluctant to make these investigations public. Why is now the right time to do that?
Well, we're getting down to the end of the witnesses that we want to interview, and we, even though we don't have the documents that we want, we've had the witnesses read the documents and describe the documents that they have, you know, offered as evidence. So we did not want to make testimony public so that witnesses could all get their testimony in a row, in a line, right? Because you know, this president was calling people traitors. He called Ambassador Taylor a traitor, basically, and said, or a spy. He basically said this: the whistleblower was a spy, and he suggested that we handle that like we did in the old ways, which is the old days. Which
this is when the president said that to that group of ambassadors or diplomatic staff.
Right. So, you know, the heart of this is really protecting the democratic process and preserving our ability to you know, prosecute this impeachment inquiry in a way that gets the best evidence. We don't want to let witnesses be influenced by other person's testimony. So we've kept that behind closed doors. That is exactly what the special prosecutors did in both the Clinton case and the Nixon case. In this case, we have an attorney general who is not willing to appoint a special prosecutor, so we have to do it as members of Congress. That's what we're doing right now.
Let's talk about a piece of the criticism of the private nature of this. You know, so we discussed Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified today. Earlier today, Congressman Jim Jordan expressed frustration that Vindman would not disclose the identity of the whistleblower. Here he is.
The idea that we want to know who this individual may have communicated with, that's important information.
So Republicans are saying, we can't get the information we need. This is too tightly controlled by the Democrats. Do you think there is any truth to that? And or does the tightness, the privacy, create the appearance of partisanship at a minimum?
Okay. Two things. One, remember, the whistleblower just told us about the conversation. And it was really third hand, right? It was hearsay. But now we have the president's own words. He has delivered a summary of the transcript in which he was basically forcing or trying to influence President Zelensky to initiate a prosecution and investigation against Joe Biden. So we don't need the whistleblower anymore. We've got better. It's all about best evidence. So that's number one. Two, The allegation of secrecy is really a canard. It's really absurd. There are 40 Republican members who are entitled to sit in on that, you know, on the depositions. Any process that has 60 Democrats and 40 Republicans in a room is not secret. I mean, there are leaks left and right from both sides, I think, in this case, and it's far from secret.
So, Congressman, I know your time is short. We'll be watching what happens next along with you. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tiziana. Good to be with you.
Stay with us. Coming up, if you feel like we just don't listen to each other anymore, you're not alone. We'll talk with the author of Know-It-All Society, Truth and Arrogance in Political Culture. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's us against them. According to my next guest, that's unfortunately the lens through which many of us now see the world. But what if the things we believe we know are true are actually a little more fuzzy than we'd like to admit? Here with me in Studio 3 is Michael Patrick Lynch, Board of Trustees, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy, and Director of the Humanities Institute at the University of Connecticut. His new book is called Know-It-All Society, Truth and Arrogance in Political Culture. Michael, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, if I can get one of those out of the way early in the segment, then we're usually all good. All right, so before we get deep into arrogance in our public discourse, I just want to start with a couple of concepts. You argue that the things people think they know are true can often actually better be described as convictions. So what is the difference between truth and conviction?
Okay, so, you know, a conviction is more than just a deeply held belief. You know, I deeply believe that, I don't know, 2 + 2 = 4, but that's not really worth calling a conviction of mine. A conviction is something that a commitment to action that reflects your identity, that reflects who you aspire to be, even if you don't always live up to it. And most importantly, for political reasons, reflects the kind of tribe you want to be associated with. And as a result, that's why attacks on our convictions feel so personal, because in a way, they are, right? Because convictions reflect our identity.
So to that point, there might be someone else whose identity is so caught up in, for example, rationality, that for them, 2 + 2 = 4 might not just be a belief. It might be a conviction. It might be a symbol for kind of their identity. Am I getting you?
You are. And, you know, of course, people are different. And, you know, I am actually a college professor, so maybe that's me, right? Secretly a conviction. But, you know, you're right. I mean, one of the things that can happen is that an opinion that is about sort of a straightforward matter of fact can become hardened into a conviction, something that reflects your identity. For example, the belief that climate change is a hoax. A lot of people have that view. And a lot of folks might start out with that view, not as a real conviction, but just as something they heard on the radio or on Fox News or something. But then they begin to, if circumstances are right, that view can become caught up in a narrative, in an ideology, in a way of being that begins to reflect the kind of identity they wish to have and portray to the world.
So they become like armor or clothing that we put on to signal.
Exactly.
All right. So there's this one other dichotomy or this and that that I want to get to right off the bat, which is lying and deception. Now, I don't like either of them particularly, but you
Me
distinguish
too.
Between them. So talk about that.
Sure. You know, I think, lying is when we say something that we believe to be false with the intention of deceiving the other person. But I can lie to you without actually successfully deceiving you. And I can deceive you without actually lying by not saying anything, for example, at all, or withholding information. That's a classic way of deception. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that often what's going on social media, particularly by purveyors of fake news, is a game of deception, but not per often deliberate lying. It doesn't have to be lying. What it can be, misinformation and disinformation can deceive people just by confusing them.
So morally, I don't mean to sound pugnacious, but morally, why do I care about that distinction? So you can say to me 2 + 2 = 5. And that's lying, but you might not successfully deceive me because I know 2 + 2 = 4. But I still might be pretty upset with you for trying to deceive me by saying 2 + 2 = 5.
The reason that it's important is for that last example that I mentioned. One of the ways in which political deception works is by not necessarily convincing people to believe something false. It might be even if they were intending to actually do that. But often they're not actually intending to do that. What often fake news purveyors, for example, whether they're political actors or individual actors, are trying to do is to deceive people, get them to not know what to believe. And that is, I argue in the book, a kind of deception. It's a type of deception via confusion. And if we don't realize that that's often one of the unfortunate consequences of this social media environment, and particularly the fake news industrial complex that we see existing in parts of, let's say, Russia, then I think we are going to miss some of the, as you say, really deep moral consequences that are falling out of this sort of practice.
All right. So, you know, there's so much here. I want to stay on the fake news thing for a second. It's really become quite a common phrase. It gets tossed around a lot. And it's true, as you say, in some places, it is true. There is a trafficking in false information, as you say, designed to deceive. Pew, a research center study from there, said that almost 70% of Americans say that fake news and misinformation have greatly affected their confidence in government institutions. And that's what I want to ask you about. When you wrote this book, you're calling foul on a lot of stuff that is structurally deeply concerning for a participatory democracy. So what is, how do we make sense of, and can we do anything about fake news?
Well, yes, we can. But first, let's address your question about how do we make sense of it. First thing to notice about fake news, the term, is that the original meaning of the term is what we're talking about, deliberately misleading and deceptive stories tailored to look like pieces of journalism.
Maybe even propaganda.
Right, exactly. And in when we think of it as propaganda, it has a history as old as human language itself. But nowadays, and I think the listeners will recognize this, the term fake news has changed its meaning in general conversation. Nowadays, it means news that we don't like. And people use it both on the left and the right to often in that way. That itself is a sign of how things have become so toxic in our political culture, because fake news, a term originally designed to help us distinguish between truth and falsity, has itself now become just an expression of emotion.
So, but if we all know that that's what someone's doing when they say fake news, if you and I and everyone else knows that what they're really saying is, I don't like that, then does it have that confusing Tory, and I'm using a not real word on purpose, power that you're talking about if we all know what you're doing when you use it?
Well, I think, unfortunately, yes, because one of the things that's that we need to sort of – and this gets to the other aspect of your question and maybe leads us a little towards hope. One of the things we need to realize –
That would be nice.
That would be nice, wouldn't it? One of the things that we need to realize is that, you know, this is fake news, the spread of fake news in the literal sense, right, the sense we were talking about a moment ago, happens on social media platforms by and large. And one of the things I think would be helpful for us all to realize is that when we're sharing content, news content online, we're often not doing what we think we're doing. We think we're doing we're sharing information with each other that is factual. We think we're playing a game of rationality. But in fact, what we're often doing is sharing content that is emotionally loaded for emotional reasons. We're building up our convictions and displaying them and signaling them to others. And that means that we're not often playing the game we think we are. We're not playing the game of reason. We're playing a game the rules of which are more like, I don't know, the water cooler or the rules of the playground.
All right. So to that point, I want to play a quick clip for you. Here is Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg during his recent congressional testimony explaining why it is Facebook's policy not to fact-check political ads.
I think lying is bad, and I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad. That's different from it being, in our position, the right thing to do to prevent your constituents or people in an election from seeing that you had lied.
What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's surprising that he had a hard time explaining a distinction that he was alleging was very clear, because it's not. I mean, if you know that your platform is being used to spread false information, particularly about politics, then it's difficult to sort of acknowledge it. Yes, I know that could be happening. In fact, I could even point it out that it's happening right here in this particular ad and not do anything about it. I mean, news platforms of the old analog sort – platforms like this one that we're I'm enjoying the luxury of the studio right now. This
we have the old sort.
Right. I mean, old in the
I'm
best, most
with you.
Classic way. But, you know, if you think about, you know, news organizations have been for a long time been able to have, you know, rules that allow for them to push back on campaigns that wish to deceive the public through advertising. So they don't have to accept all that advertising. I think Facebook to put it a little bit more nicely, they're still struggling, shall we say, with a rational response to the use of their platform as a propaganda machine.
All right. So there's this other piece that I want to get to, and we don't have time to go in as deeply as I'd like, but I want to get to the concept of trust for a second, and relationship, tribalism, conflict, conviction, trust. Like, we'll just do that in like 2 minutes. We talked to Maine State Rep Chris Babbage, and he was talking about the effort to bring civility back to the Maine State Legislature. They did a number of things to try to, get there. In the process, he talked about the importance of forming trust and how crucial that is when you're trying to get to compromise and find a way forward.
The Maine Development Foundation sponsors economic trips around the state for legislators to become more familiar with some of the drivers of the Maine economy. And those trips happen very early on at the beginning of a session, often before we might even know the political party of our colleagues. And so we develop a relationship with each other prior to getting into the weeds and into the, some of the difficult decisions later on.
So is this ability to form trust through relationships, through interpersonal contact versus what I see in Twitter or what I hear in Facebook, essential to finding a way through this morass? And does it soften the power of conviction so that maybe I'm more open to change or to your side?
Absolutely. I think that's a really important point. When we talk about our convictions, we're talking about ourselves and what we aspire to be. And in order to be open to negotiating those convictions with another human being, you've got to actually stop confusing truth and ego. You mentioned truth before. I think a real barrier to real meaningful political discourse is the idea that what I say is true because it's mine. It's my side. I know because I am who I am. That confusion of truth and ego is a barrier to trust. It's a barrier to trust in a relationship, as all of us know, and it's a barrier to trust to a healthy political democracy.
So how do we get in our dialogues, in our interactions, especially in a time when people are so angry, how do we get past ego into a place where we can engage?
Well, I'd ask listeners to think about two simple things. One thing to think about is the fact that the next time you're, you know, as I often do, getting really mad, in my case, at Trump because I'm a liberal progressive, think about, is there some aspect of this debate where I think that maybe I could still learn something? Maybe not from Trump, but maybe from talking to somebody or talking to a family member or just simply digging down a little bit more, just reflecting a little bit on, do I actually know everything about what I'm talking about here? That's actually a really simple but important strategy. It's just to reflect on that. That helps you stop confusing ego and truth. And then another thing, which is also pretty simple, is sometimes to pull yourself away from the black mirror of your phone and actually maybe have a conversation with somebody. Because one of the things that I think is pretty clear is it's easier to be outraged when you're online because there's no consequences. It's harder to be outraged, and it's also perhaps a little easier to form some relationship if you actually, you know, do what Socrates suggests thousands of years ago and talk to another human being.
That's all very local. That's very interpersonal. Is that the way we have to proceed one-on-one in our local communities?
Institutional change is essential, but there's no such thing as institutional change without individual change.
That is Michael Patrick Lynch, Board of Trustees, Distinguished Professor of Philosophy, and Director of the Humanities Institute at the University of Connecticut. His new book is called Know-It-All Society, Truth and Arrogance in Political Culture. Michael, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay with us. Coming up, we're going to talk about haunted houses, and we're going to take your calls. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. Haunted houses. Some people love them.
It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
Others do not.
Here's Johnny.
Halloween is a $9 billion industry in the U.S., and every year, haunted houses across New England attract people who want to be scared or to conquer their fear. So why do some of us love to be scared, and what does it take to scare us good? Joining us in Studio 3 is Skip Dillon, president of both Wicked Amusements and Chambers of Terror in Salem. Skip, hello.
Welcome to myself.
I thought you were going to...
And thank you so much for having me.
I thought you were going to welcome me to the horror already. I don't want to be scared.
not just yet.
Also joining us on the line from Burlington, Vermont, is Tony Magistrale. He's a professor at the University of Vermont, where he teaches English and film, and he's written about Gothic horror, Edgar Allan Poe, Stephen King. He also researched the history of the haunted house for Stephen King, which raises your cred even higher. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good evening.
Excellent.
Oh, now he's just going to show me up.
All right. Now listen.
We can both play that game, you know.
This is going to be good, y'all. But before we start with our panel, I want to join the conversation. Call us. What scares you? What is your favorite way to scare yourself on Halloween? And are there some experiences that are better or worse for you? Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, so I'm going to ask you both the same question to start. Skip, I'll go to you first. How did you become a scare expert?
Well, as I generally describe myself, I grew up a theatrical jack of all trades and master of maybe 2.5. And when I was 19 years old, I started working at a haunted attraction called Terror on the Wharf in Salem, Massachusetts, which just happens to be located in the exact same building and location that my attraction is located in now, 25 years later. And I immediately fell in love with the production, the design, the creation of these attractions, despite the fact that when I was a child, I was terrified by haunted houses. I did not like horror movies. It is something that I grew into as an adult when I got the chance to actually scare people myself.
All right, Tony, how about you? You are an expert in sort of the history of the scare. How did that come about?
Well, the first thing I want to ask Skip is if I could have a guided tour of his amusement.
Yeah,
awesome.
I'll drive to Salem and you can give me a tour.
Whenever you like, sir.
We will hook you guys up with contact information for each other after the segment, because I would love to know that happened.
Very cool. Well, you know, I came at things from a very different angle than Skip just described. Skip has this empirical relationship to horror. For me, it was all academic. What happened was I had a professor when I was an undergraduate who was an expert in the Gothic, and I took several courses with him and began to realize that the Gothic was not just about, you know, freaky stuff that was going on in Halloween, but also that it was this amazing strain that ran through some of the great literature of the last three centuries, for instance.
So, Skip, I want to pick up on that for a second, something Tony just said. He talked about the great literature. Here's one of the things that's interesting. So many people love horror. They love to be scared. They love haunted houses. And yet it consistently has this lowbrow reputation. Right. And I don't understand that, because people rely on it for a key piece of life. So how do we explain that we almost sort of resent or put down the things that we do for this essence of fear and thrill?
I think that because it is tied into that reflexive adrenaline rush, dopamine release, nature of thrill attractions in general, that it is such a reflexive, instinctive response. It is a base response, an animalistic response.
Interesting.
And I think that it is not a terribly cerebral thing at its core essence. And that's why people have a tendency to maybe look down on it as not being something that's elevated to the degree that it should be, frankly.
So, Tony, to Skip's point, we talked with Dr. Marnie Chanoff, a psychiatrist who's on faculty at Harvard Medical School, and McLean. We wanted to physiologically understand what's happening when a person experiences fear. Here she is.
Part of the response is a sense of arousal in the body on a physical level. So, you know, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, you feel very alive and engaged. People feel like they are really kind of in the body and experiencing the full capacity of the body, and which some people don't feel all that often. you know, they get surges of those stress hormones, but also dopamine, which can feel very pleasurable for some people who can tolerate it. So there's a whole surge of neurotransmitters and hormones that get evoked.
So there's a lot going on there, and we haven't always had the kinds of technologies that Skip may have available to him today, Tony, to bring that out. And yet throughout history, we have found ways to strike terror in others' hearts. Well, you know, where does that come from? How do we do it in the old days?
Well, I just want to address where the focus of horror came, of modern horror came in the 18th century, because here you've got this great dichotomy that's created in the 18th century. The 18th century is known as the Age of Enlightenment. It was the era of reason and rationality. The great Americans that put together the Constitution were all deists, were all rational people. Jefferson, Ben Franklin. It was the age of science. Chemistry, physics was born in the 18th century. But careful, because as you get closer to the end of the century, all that the lights go out in the Enlightenment. And what takes over is the haunted house. It begins in about 1763 with the Castle of Otranto. And then when you get to the last decade of the 18th century, you've got not only the revolutions in France and the United States, but you've also got literally hundreds of Gothic texts that are produced in the 1790s.
So,
and that's designed not to take you to a place of rationality, but to take you to a place of, you know, what we've been talking about here, visceral physical response.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Have you been to a haunted house yet this year? Have you been to Skip's haunted house yet this year? Are you reading Gothic horror? What do you like to do to scare yourself? Or are you like me? Do you want to do nothing to scare yourself because you hate being scared? Give us a call. Skip, so Tony just took us back hundreds of years. There's that old adage that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Is scaring people through, you know, a haunted house any different today than it was hundreds of years ago?
I would say that what has been elevated in the last 25 years is primarily the immersive production value of these attractions. The core fundamental design psychology behind scaring people has not changed, because what scares people has not changed. And so the most effective attractions out there from a scare perspective are primarily tapping into xenophobia, fear of things that are foreign to us, things that are unknown to us. In our attraction, we like to use non-humanoid morphologies for our characters, because that is a distressing thing when you see something that is insectoid or
a
lamprey-mouthed ghoul come out of the corner and then retract into the darkness. The more that they can recognize and find a basis of relevance to the less that they're generally scared of it. However, it is worth noting that while 25 years ago, these attractions were mainly the domain of the 4-H clubs and the JCs and other charity organizations,
local churches
in the Southwest doing the Hell House type of attraction and whatnot. As you said, it is now a industry that makes billions and billions of dollars per year, and you can go into your local Home Depot or at a temporary Spirit Halloween store and purchase props that 25 years ago would have cost thousands and thousands in custom fabrication for a couple $100 and deck your entire house out. So that has certainly escalated the expectations of the customer base in terms of they want to see a Disney quality immersive environment attraction and
walk-through
movie. Does that
make it harder for you to keep up?
It makes it certainly something that requires a different level of production expertise, a different level of investment, certainly fiscally in these attractions. But ultimately, at the end of the day, if you design an attraction efficiently and you understand what scares people and you have the right actors, and I can't underscore that enough, then the attraction is going to be a good haunted house.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Gordon from Shirley, you are on the line. What's on your mind?
It seems like so many horror movies and horror novels focus on one kind of threat to the human being. Physical safety comes into play. But there are so many other kinds of things that are truly horrible that never sort of make it into the genre of movies and novels. For example, fear of cancer, fear of losing all your money, or let's take it up a real big notch to being hauled off in the Holocaust on the night of Kristallnacht. There are some threats to real people's lives that are truly horrible, but that don't make it into this genre of entertainment.
Thanks for raising that, Gordon. And Tony, I'm going to turn to you. You know, as Gordon said those things, I have to admit, I got goosebumps on my neck, that my hair stood up. I got a feeling of dread. But I also thought it would feel wrong to seek fear via entertainment using subjects like that. Is there a history behind that or a perspective that you can provide?
Yeah, I think it's really important to distinguish the various levels of terror that that we experience aesthetically and that we experience through literature, through art, through music, and even through film. On one level, there is that, you know, that that terrifying somebody's in the basement, or don't look into that closet, that visceral fear. But there's also always that an element of the psychological that's at work. This is what made Poe so great in the 19th century, is that Poe, there are very few supernatural events that occur in Poe's fiction. Most of it is all about the mind unraveling, yeah, or the mind under duress. And I think that's part of what the caller, the person who just
Gordon,
left that message, Gordon, was referring to, that human beings are, let's face it, we are extraordinarily vulnerable at the same time as we're resilient.
Yeah. 1-800 go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think it's that vulnerability that makes also, this is what's so ironic, it makes for great art, too.
Yeah. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jordan's on the line from Cambridge. Jordan, jump in.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I go to haunted houses every year. It's actually not my favorite thing to do, but my partner likes to do it. I think all haunted houses, or at least the ones I've experienced, do the startled tactic. And it seems kind of old and redundant. It works. I'm scared. My heart rate is up. But I'd also like to see something new.
So thanks for that call, Jordan. Skip, I mean, you're in the industry. What's new? What's coming next? What's the cutting edge?
I think that I'd like to certainly address the prevalence of jump scares in attractions. And there's a reason that the jump scares are there. One is that it is certainly a blanket thing that works very effectively. And two, frankly, is that it is conducive to throughput. And at the end
meaning
of the day,
churning people,
yeah,
through
at
the space.
End of the day, haunted attractions have to move people through at a certain rate, put a certain number of people into the front scene, and move them through every couple of minutes or whatever the case may be. And the larger the attraction, so if you take the scale of a Scream Park attraction or a Universal Studios attraction, they need to just move people through almost in a conga line, double or triple file. And unfortunately, what that does is it removes the ability to set up more cerebral scares, to play with the audience as much. At my attraction in Salem, it is a very small attraction, as all the attractions are, and we don't worry as much about throughput there. And so we are able to stage scares and psychological effects that, which is not to say that we don't use jump scares, because we certainly do. But to just throw one quick example out, in the first room of my attraction, the guests are greeted by a guide character who has a lantern. And the guide character, after getting a scare in on them, makes them realize that they have to follow him, follow the light of that lantern. And then they are abandoned by that character.
I hate you.
Later.
I would never do that.
You see the reaction that you have.
I'm not even there.
And then later in the attraction, they're picked back up by that guide character again.
Oh, my God.
And then they are abandoned a second time and made to walk into an area that is pitch black.
Yeah.
No lighting. They have to feel their way through. And as you might imagine, the walls are covered in disconcerting textures and wet things, that are off-putting. And these are not new technologies by any means, but it's something that we're able to do because we don't have the throughput requirements that a larger attraction would.
So, Tony, that it's awful. Why are you and I both laughing, right?
Well,
Why are we laughing?
Well, because first of all, I'm thinking when that guide comes and connects with you and skips attraction the second time, that guide's also a psychotherapist.
Yes.
You know, just sit down with you and say, okay, let's talk about what you've been through.
Is that right, Skip?
not so much. They're bringing them into the graveyard of spiders, which is an arachnophobe's worst nightmare, to be sure. But certainly they are baiting them with a false sense of security, and they should know better because they already should know to distrust that character at that point. But they are so grateful to have the light of that lantern again.
Hey, let's take one more call. We've got Nora from Marblehead on the line. Nora, go ahead.
Hi, I was actually an actress in a literary haunted house at the House of the Seven Gables in Salem. Oh. We are putting on two shows every weekend in October leading up to Halloween. In one, we're telling the legacy of the Hanging Judge, Nathaniel Hawthorne's ancestor. And the one I was in is a retelling of the story of the House of the Seven Gables. And I think the scariest thing in that getup is the audience when they come in fully masked and you're acting in front of them like just 3 yards away and you have no idea what's going on in their faces.
Thanks for that, Nora, because I don't think, Skip, that anyone thinks about whether or not the people putting on the scare are ever uncomfortable or scared.
Absolutely. It is a risky profession. There is a ingrained fight or flight response in people. And then you have folks that do come through looking to cause trouble. And while we do our best to sort those people out in line with security, sometimes it just happens accidentally. We had one of my actors was given a bloody nose by a young woman completely accidentally. And just she had that reflexive, uncontrollable physical response to throw her hand out. And I had to sit down with him afterwards as he was icing his nose and filling out the incident report and say, hey, you know, you did a great job and that's why that happened.
Congratulations. Yeah. All right. So go ahead,
Tony. The horror came back to you, Skip, like, oh, no, you're going to sue me.
No.
So, Tony, I want to we've only got a couple minutes left. And so I'm going to give short shrift to this. But I do want to ask you to address the difference between that which is scary and that which is deeply disturbing. Mm. And how do we think about the line between those things? I'll just leave it there.
Well, I'm thinking of the incident that Skip just described, and I'm thinking of the fact that, you know, here you've got a massive group of people going through a house or going through an amusement, and there's a mixture of fear and humor that's going on. People are in good spirits, and they know that they're going to be scared, and that creates all sorts of mixed receptors that are going off. But what happens when suddenly a true freak, a true ghoul comes into that scene and decides to cause chaos? That's when the joy of terror, the joy of horror, turns into something truly disturbing. We've seen a lot of that in school shootings every day in this country. You know, where suddenly there's this abrupt experience where kids are terrified.
Yeah.
There's nothing joyous about that. That's just horror in its purest form.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but we actually need to. That's Tony Magistrale. He's a professor at the University of Vermont, where he teaches English and film. And we also have Skip Dillon, president of both Wicked Amusements and Chamber of Terror in Salem. Thanks to both of you, Skip and Tony.
And a thank you to you, too.
It was our pleasure.
Awesome. Awesome. That is our show for today. And can I just say, I love my job. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.